My name is Richard Scherer, and I represent the Plaintiff Appellant Taxpayers. That's the collective name we use for all of the plaintiffs. Ladies and gentlemen, I understand you've read all the briefs. I believe that just about everything, if not everything, that needs to be said about this case is in the briefs. So I don't have any earth-shattering news for you. But I do want to put a different perspective on it. It's a perspective I came to while preparing for this oral argument. The first thing I want to say, this is not a challenge to a Tabor ballot question. This is a case to enforce a Tabor ballot question. No different. So that's the starting place. And it should be a simple issue. The issue is whether Cimarron Hills Fire Protection District can increase their mill levy over 7.598 mills pursuant to a 1996 ballot question. Now, it sounds simple enough when the ballot question has language that says that the mill levy will be increased from 4.667 and it will go up to 0.931 to an amount that's not to exceed 7.598. Okay, so that far sounds easy. And that's the position of the taxpayers. However, there is a problem. The problem is that there is what appears to be a proofreading error in the document. And so then the question becomes, what do you do with it? The taxpayers and Cimarron Hills both contend that the language is unambiguous and should be enforced on its face. They just have different views of what it means.
So it's your position that it's unambiguous, notwithstanding that it says and thereafter, comma, and thereafter?
Yes, because we believe that the not to exceed 7.596 and thereafter means it will not exceed 7.596 then in 1997 or thereafter. That is our interpretation of the language. But it's those two thereafter clauses that cause the problem. And so the trial court decided it's going to fix it. And let me digress for just a minute. When you read the order of the trial court, It's as dense as the trial court claims the language of the ballot question is, maybe more so. I think counsel and the trial court may have made this a lot more difficult than it really is. The real issue is pretty straightforward. It's what do you do with those two and therefore clauses? Now, the trial court's solution was to strike one of them out. We've cited cases in our brief that say if you're going to go and use the Scrivener's Doctrine rule, it doesn't mean you have to strike things out. You can add things back in. And what we want to put back in there, if there's ambiguity, is the language out of the Tabor ballot notice that was sent out at the same time in 1996. And that Tabor ballot notice that was sent out is supposed to have the same language. And what it says is in it, and the best evidence we have is a draft that we got from their attorney's file, Mr. Kinn. And he said he has no reason to believe that the draft is any different than the one that was actually sent out to the taxpayers, all the taxpayers, not just our clients, for them to consider when voting. And what that ballot notice has in it, and it is found as Exhibit 3 in the record, it's it is the fourth page of Exhibit 3. It's Cimarron Hills bait number 001042. Now, that document has in it an amount, a specific amount, that could be the amount, it was the estimated amount, if they raised the mill levy to the 7.598 amount. Now, that's the way it's supposed to be done. That's what goes in between the and therefore clauses. That's what was between the and therefore clauses in the Tabor notice.
Could you read the language, since you have it there, from starting with the first and thereafter to the end of the second and thereafter? Could you just read that for us?
The notice?
Yes.
May I go and get it out of?
Oh, you don't have it with you. That's fine.
Well, I have it. I'm not sure I can find it in my.
Okay, don't take time now.
But it's pretty simple. Let me see. If you don't mind, I have it marked.
Okay.
This is important to the argument in the sense that Okay, let's see here. Here's the way it reads in the notice. It's also exhibit NNN in the Sumon Hills exhibits, but exhibit 3 is the one we've used in our analysis and which we've actually quoted in our briefs. And here's how it works. It says, for no levy for general operating expenses not to exceed 7.5980 and thereafter, and for taxes to be increased in an amount estimated to be $197,946 in the first year, and thereafter, as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth. See, the problem is they forgot that when they did the ballot.
It's in the rules. But aren't you, isn't your client effectively asking us to rewrite the ballot? And isn't that the prerogative of the taxpayers? If they want to rewrite it, why don't they just pass a new ballot?
I understand the question, I think. The question is this. When the trial court rewrote the ballot, because he had to do that to get to his interpretation, he struck out one of the end therefore thereafter clauses, and that caused all of the stuff that goes to the third leg, second and third legs of Tabor, to be attributed to the mill levy increase. So the court's already rewritten the ballot, and that's what we're upset about. We think he did it wrong. He struck out language and caused the remaining language in the ballot question to be applied to mill levy increases.
Didn't the parties concede that the second thereafter was repetitive or wasn't appropriate?
No. What the position of the parties was, and you can find this in the record, the court even acknowledged it, is that in the decision by the court on page 2031 of the record, and as discussed on page 8 of our opening brief, the court pointed out that if these numbers have been between the two thereafter clause, both parties agree that the maximum mill levy would be the 7.598 number. Now, the court could not have done his analysis until after he reformed the ballot language. The whole order is based upon his reformation, deleting one of the and therefore clauses, and none of us, at least not on the taxpayer's side, agreed that it was superfluous. Only if you want to claim that the language is completely clear on its face, and then you could delete the second and thereafter. But you have to understand how Tabor works and how these ballot questions work. And this is where Judge Prince got lost, respectfully. Tabor has three different limitations. I'm super condensing it because it has a lot of stuff in it. But one of them is it limits mill levies. That's the tax rate. And the second thing it does is it limits the amount of money that you can collect. So, you know, Douglas had the idea of belt suspenders and another set of suspenders. And the second set of suspenders, third prong of Tabor that's relevant to this analysis, is first it limits the tax rate, then it limits how much you can collect, and then it limits how much you can spend. Everything after the second and thereafter clause relates to the what they call debrucing aspect. Once you raise your mill levy to 7.598, you get more money. But you have to also get the taxpayers to agree that you can collect it and that you can spend it. And hence the rest of the language after the second thereafter clause. It doesn't make sense in the context of Tabor to put any other interpretation on this.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Shearer. Let's look at that language after thereafter. It says, as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth to the extent permitted by Article 10, Section 20. What does that phrase mean, to the extent permitted by Article 10, Section 20?
The discussion that we have in our briefs is this. Mr. Kinn, when he changed his opinion in 2004 from what he had given in 1997, that the 7.598 was the maximum, he then flipped in 2004. And what he did was he said inflation and growth was his justification for this, and that's found in Section 7 of that particular citation to the Tabor Act. Section 7 only deals with those back two prongs, the ability to collect and the ability to spend the money. It has absolutely nothing to do with mill levy increases, which are governed by Section 4.
The, to the extent permitted by Article 10, would limit spending and it would limit revenue. I mean, as I read this, to the extent permitted by Article 10, meaning you can't raise more revenue, nor can you spend more money other than based on inflation and growth.
If I could correct you,
yeah.
It's you can't collect more money or spend more money. The tax rate is where you get the raising the money, and that's the Section 4 stuff.
Right, I understand.
And what's important is these are words of art in Tabor. The words inflation and growth are words of art in Tabor, and they apply only to Section 7. They're not words of art that have some common meaning that you can ascribe and say, oh, well, you can tack them on to a mill levy increase as part of a formula. And the important part about that is that's where Mr. Kim got wrong, and that's where Mr. Gray, who's present in the courtroom, a Tabor expert, gave them an opinion in 2009 that said this is a violation of Tabor. They hired him. And it came up in 2009 because they had a fire chief from a neighboring fire district that I am counsel for, and he said, I can't sign your auditor's letter saying that you're not violating Tabor because I think you are.
But it's undisputed, though, in the trial court at least, that this did not violate. Even if the your adversary's interpretation is correct, that the formula does not violate Tabor. That's what you said. Someone, I don't know if it was you, counsel was arguing in the closing statement said, and the trial court. But there wasn't.
That statement is out of context. The violation of Tabor can be in many different ways. It can be the way you structure the ballot question. It can be the way you try and apply it. And what we're saying is it does violate Tabor if the ballot question says what we says, what we say it says, then it does violate Tabor.
What if we accept your opponent's interpretation? If we accept the interpretation that the district was allowed to or authorized to collect more than the 7.5980 levy. If we buy into the interpretation that the voters approved that, then is there a Tabor challenge?
Absolutely.
What is it then?
It's an unlimited tax increase with compounding. It's an absolutely absurd result. There's no limit on it, which is the whole point of Tabor, is to limit growth of government. There's no limit. They can just keep going. It compounds and it double counts because you see, inflation and growth are, under Section 7, always included in assessed value. If you then multiply the tax rate, which is also increased by inflation and growth, you get a double counting effect. It's not one to one, but you've got both things increasing the tax rate, and you have essentially no limit. It can just keep going forever.
So is your contention with regard to the double counting that inflation accounts for some of the same things that the annual growth also accounts for? Is that your
no.
Okay, so what is your
concepts?
What is your
annual growth is new construction increased
right.
value by the assessor. Inflation is when your buck's worth less. And you look at the CPI for that. That's the consumer price index. Both of those factors are used by the county assessor when determining first actual value and then the percentage of actual value that's assessed value. And so inflation and growth are automatically included in the idea of what you multiply times your tax rate. In other words, the tax rate is one, and you multiply it times 10, but inflation and growth increase the tax rate by to 11. What they're doing is they're taking one and multiplying that two, increasing that two by inflation and growth, and then multiplying it times the 11. They're using it twice. And it's not a one-for-one ratio. We're not claiming that. But the result is not what anybody intended. You will never find anything in any of the pre-2004 documents that gives any of these taxpayers a clue that they're planning on using this as a formula. The word formula doesn't appear. The lawyer doesn't use it. In fact, he has the opposite conclusion all the way until 2004. There is no way the taxpayers could have understood or intended, and that's your question, could have intended that there was going to be a formula. You can't find it in the evidence. They can claim it all they want, but it's just not there. It's supposed to be in the Tabor notice if that's what they had in mind. That's not what they had in mind. In fact, in the Tabor notice, they have the amount that both sides agreed, and Mr. Weiser, the expert, testified, would have limited this to a not to exceed 7.598. If you're not going to enforce it on its face, at least put the right language in instead of doing what the judge did to change the whole meaning of this ballot question. That was to delete the second and therefore. That is not supported by the evidence, and it's not supported by common sense. And is my time up?
Time is up, but I have some questions for you. As I read the ballot initiative, it says that the mill levy shall be increased by a certain amount beginning in January 1997
right.
for a total levy for operating expenses not to exceed 7.6. And thereafter. And as I understand your argument, the following phrase that was left out, and for taxes estimated to be whatever the taxes were, I don't understand how that helps us understand that phrase 7.6 and thereafter.
That's the modifier effect that we discussed in our briefs. The and thereafter then modifies the tax rate. It does not work to give new meaning to the second leg of the Tabor analysis the way that Judge Prince did it.
So do I understand correctly then that you're saying that and thereafter and for taxes to be estimated at, and there's a dollar amount there.
Right, in the first year.
And is that dollar amount of significance to your argument?
Absolutely it is. And everyone agreed on this. Even their expert, D. Weiser, agrees on it. David Grayer agrees on it. I do a lot of table work, you know, all of us. The way you draft one of these ballot questions is to put in a maximum mill levy, you put the amount of the first year, the estimated amount between the two and therefore clauses. This is just cookie cutter type stuff. It's just they forgot the number in between. No one would have expected when you see a not to exceed 7.598 to be anything else. And with that number in there, all of the people that draft these ballot questions agree it would be limited to 7.598. So if we're going to
so you're saying that the specific amount then further clarifies that the mill levy limit for all time,
right,
until the next initiative is 7.598.
Right, and as we discussed in our brief, when you combine that with the word such rate increase, then it becomes even more clear how they work together. And that clarifies what the modifier is in it. And on that issue, one thing that we haven't talked about that's related is there is not a case out there that allows an O&M formula, operations and maintenance formula.
No, we're not going to go there. Your time's expired. Thank you. As we ask so many questions, I anticipate we'll give Mr. Shearer a chance to do rebuttal argument.
That please the court. My name is Andy Nathan, registration number 3295, and I represent the Cimarron Hills Fire Protection District. Tabor really empowers voters to decide what the size of government is. And they're empowered in two ways. One is through Tabor questions, and the second is by electing their board, in this case every 2 years, so that the board can decide what their budget is and should be consistent with what they're allowed to do under Tabor. But this case isn't about Tabor. I disagree with Mr. Shearer, because the plaintiffs have waived all their Tabor arguments. And to quote page 93 of the last day transcript, Mr. Scherer was answering the court's questions is whether or not a formula violates Tabor. And Mr. Scherer said, I think the simple answer is if the court adopts the defendant's interpretation of the 1996 ballot question, it is not a violation of Tabor. The court did adopt our interpretation, and it is not a violation of Tabor. The court's simple approach to analyzing the ballot issue is the correct one, because we're not dealing with legislatures or lawyers. The court looked at the ballot question and accorded the words their plain and common meaning, using basic rules of grammar and sentence construction, and determined that the plaintiff's proposed interpretation would require the court to disregard all of those rules at each step. So while the trial court...
Wait a minute. Say that again, please.
The trial court found that to use the plaintiff's interpretation of the ballot question would violate basic rules of grammar and sentence construction at each step.
Let me ask, I mean, apart from whether this violates Tabor, you're bound by this initiative. Whatever it says, you're bound by what it says.
We are.
Okay. And that's the issue before us.
And that's
the issue. What does it say?
What does it say?
Is it ambiguous, Mr. Nathan?
What?
Is the ballot measure ambiguous?
It is not, Your Honor. I do not believe.
Even with the two and thereafters?
Yes, because as Mr. Scherer pointed out in his closing argument at the trial court, you can see how the first and thereafter came to exist, because a phrase was taken out of the original draft of the Tabor question, and we have only the draft notice. Neither the plaintiffs nor the defendants have been able to go back to 1996 and find the original or the final notice. We only have a draft notice.
If that phrase were inserted in here, would it change your interpretation of the initiative?
You mean if we were to add the phrase back, putting in the dollar figure?
Yes.
Yeah, then I think it might change my interpretation. But it isn't in there.
It's not ambiguous. Am I correct? We cannot consider that?
Well, if it's not ambiguous, I don't think you can consider that. You can decide whether or not and thereafter is a Scribner's error and then decide whether it goes out. I'm just saying that there was an admittedly extensive evidence reason for why that extra phrase was in there. But if you now I want to note that in the trial court, the plaintiffs argued that all of that and thereafter, all the way down to the semicolon, should have been taken out. It was not appropriate. They didn't argue that both phrases should be in there. They argued to the contrary. Now, in their reply brief, they argued that they should be in there, but it doesn't make any sense if they are. And here's why. Because what you're doing is you're saying you may have 7.598 mils, and for 1997 and thereafter, and then as adjusted per section 7 of Tabor for inflation and annual growth. And then it turns around and says, but we're debruising this, so we're not going to limit you to section 7. So why would that language be
now there? Let's walk through that. So the first part of that paragraph says expenses mill levy not to exceed 7.598, and that's a specific amount, that's a specific mill levy. If the words and thereafter are ignored,
yes,
and thereafter as adjusted, which would seem to mean the mill levy as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth to the extent permitted by Article 10. What does that phrase mean, to the extent permitted by Article 10?
To me, it is a savings clause. It's saying, okay, if this formula is not proper under Tabor, and we're dealing with something that occurred 4 years after Tabor was in place, and we don't have all the case law, if this formula is not proper, then it's only to the extent permitted by Tabor. I mean, it's the only thing it can mean.
Let me understand. You don't think it means to the extent permitted by the spending and revenue limits of Article 10?
I think it means just that, except it's saying that if the as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth is not permitted by Tabor, then it's a savings clause that takes us back to the 7.598.
Okay, and I'm not sure I understand. So if we have 7.598,
yes,
and we raise with that amount enough money, and then several years later, the spending and revenue limits would cause us to have to give up some money. In other words, I guess let's go back. We have a recession, and in that recession, then our revenue goes down, our spending goes down, and the next year we're limited to that new baseline.
Right, it ratchets down. This unratchets that.
So explain to me how that unratchets it. It looks to me like it says, you're to the extent that 7 and 8. Allow you to do it. You can do it, but only if 7 and 8 allow you to do it.
You can do it. That is adjust the mill levy per year for inflation and annual growth to the extent that it is permitted by Tabor. Having decided already, though, at the trial level, that Tabor does not deny us the use of a formula, then this clause is unnecessary.
So you're saying this entire clause is unnecessary?
No, I'm saying that the clause, to the extent permitted by Article 10, is unnecessary because the formula is permitted by Article 10.
Let me ask you this. Was the trial court correct in construing the dispute here in terms of what everybody's arguing about is whether the voters authorize a formula, but not how that formula applies and when the limitations go to how the formula applies?
Well, we went through them in the trial court, and essentially it was agreed that if the formula that we applied actually applied, we did it right. In other words, we didn't raise the mill levy higher than the formula would permit. It's a definitive formula in that you can calculate it, and we did for every year, and both sides have argued that at the trial court. But the end result is that was not the issue facing the trial court, because there was a concession that if we did it the way we did it, and if this question allowed us to do it, then we did not violate Tabor.
Apart from whether you violated Tabor, I mean, the question is, what does this mean? And I guess as I'm reading this, it would appear to me to mean this. You've debruced the need to go before the public and ask for a mill levy increase. That's debruced. You have not debruced spending and revenue limits. 7 and 8 continue to exist. 7 and 8 constrain what you can do with your mill levy. And to the extent you want to adjust your mill levy, you're free to do that because you debruced it.
Okay, but
you're still subject to 7 and 8.
Second and third phrases debruce of this question. The first phrase relates to mill levy, not to revenue or spending
right.
Limits.
Good.
And so I'm saying this question does two things. It says you may adjust your mill levy rate by a formula for inflation and annual growth, and that helps you in years where actual assessed value goes down, like we just had. And then you may spend that money, because we're not going to limit you to inflation and annual growth, because we have debruced.
You've not debruced spending and revenue limits.
Yes, we have.
Where does it say that?
It says that in both the second and the third clause.
So we're on the same page. What are the second and third clauses?
And the second clause is after the semicolon, saying such voter approved revenue change to be an exception to the limits which would otherwise apply. And then the third one saying, and shall they be entitled to collect and spend the full revenues from such tax increase in any year after the first full year, which is in effect, without any other limitation or condition. So the second clause and the third clause debruce this question, and they also relate to any other law. They say under table or any other law, and there are certain other laws that might have applied.
It says such tax increase and approved revenue change. Where are the antecedents there then? What's such voter approved revenue change?
The increase in the mill levy, which allows you to take more money as a measure of the taxes that you get to receive. I mean, it really goes to assessed value. Because assessed value is not actual value, which is what growth is. Assessed value is the assessor assessing the value of it and then multiplying that times a percentage rate, which is different for both commercial and residential real estate. And under the Gallagher Amendment, for residential, that goes down. So there are districts that may have significant differences in assessed value because of the rates applied to the actual value. And in some years, that may go down. So if you change from a district that's 90% commercial to one that's 10% commercial, 90% residential, your assessed value is going to drop down significantly as a percentage of actual value. And so it's not unusual, we think, for the plain language to have voters say, this is a fire protection district, it's a health and safety district, and we're going to allow our elected board, and there's been four board elections since this question was first employed in 2004. We're going to allow our elected board, as a form of democracy, of representative democracy, to go ahead and increase the mill levy without going back to us if they do it per a formula that we have prescribed in this. And the district has done that. And you're looking at the plain, simple language, and I'm going to quote from Mesa County because I think it's an interesting quote. The Supreme Court said, to make this form of direct democracy work, districts must be able to rely on the language of ballot issues. And this ballot issue says that the as adjusted can only mean the mill levy rate.
Excuse me, let me go back to that. And thereafter, as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth to the extent permitted. Now, to me, the words to the extent permitted are words of limitation.
And to me, that there are savings clause to avoid having part of this question be determined to have violated Tabor, and you're still saving.
To what extent would it not be permitted? I mean, that language, it seems to me you're rendering it surplus. Thereafter, as adjusted for inflation to the extent permitted by Article 10. So it would seem then that what you're saying is it's always permitted by Article 10. It is never not permitted.
And what we're saying is that in 4 years after Tabor was passed, there were questions about what was permitted, and it was not unusual to put a savings clause in a Tabor question so that it's like a severability clause, so that at least part of it is saved. And as D. Weiser indicated, yes, he believes a formula is permitted, but the plaintiffs originally argued the formula was not permitted. That was a violation of Tabor in and of itself. Now, they conceded that later on, so it's not an issue here. But obviously, if you put in a savings clause, like a severability clause, and it turns out that you're not violating the law, then yes, it is superfluous, but not when you put it in there.
So let me understand. So as a savings clause, I would understand this to mean that in thereafter, as adjusted for inflation plus growth, unless a court later decides that Article 10 does not allow that?
Yes, to the extent permitted by Article 10.
Is your interpretation, does that depend upon the court's determination of a Scrivener's error, or do you think it stands up even if the both and thereafter remain in the text?
I think it stands up. It makes it more dense. But I don't think it makes it ambiguous, because if you look at the phrase, as adjusted for inflation plus annual growth, that phrase has to modify mill levy. There is nothing else. There's no statement of revenue there. The trial court said you can't add words in here like revenue. You can't assume that the voters are, knew that maybe this could be dealing with terms of art that were involved in Title VII or Section VII, and especially the trial court said, because you can use those terms of art any way you want, any time you want. And so this is what we think is a tyranny of the minority, 13 people coming in and saying, no, we don't like this question. We don't think it's good, and therefore we want to change it, even though the voters passed it. And this is the way it's been going on with election after election for 16 years.
Well, apart from that characterization, I mean, we're here to interpret these words.
Yes.
And it may be apparent to you that we're having a difficult time interpreting them. And in that regard, then, it would seem to be that this is a good faith case to have come before the courts.
I'm not arguing it's not a good faith case, Your Honor, and I'm not arguing that it's not a question that has some difficulties, but I think the trial court did an excellent job of parsing through all of this, better than I did in my closing argument, for sure.
And so I want to go to the second clause now. Such voter-approved revenue change, and your understanding of that, your interpretation is not only the revenue change that is approved for 7.598, but any other revenue change that occurs thereafter as adjusted for inflation and growth.
Yes, my assertion is that the revenue change is both for the change in mill levy and then for Section 3 spending, which says we can spend it all because we have debruced.
And so, and the third one says, and shall be entitled to collect and spend full revenues from such tax increase.
Yes.
And the tax increase there is referring to any increase in tax resulting from this formulaic adjustment.
Exactly. My position.
Are there any other questions?
Yes. Mr. Shearer said there are no cases that would support such a formula being consistent with Tabor. Do you disagree with that?
No, either D. Weiser testified that there are a number of cases that are like this. They're not. There's no cases exactly on point. Of course, there's no Tabor cases on a fire district or a life-saving. We're talking about library districts and school districts and that sort of thing. But if you read the testimony of Mr. Weiser, he goes through a series of cases that use formulas in different degrees, and while some of them involve bond issues, one of the cases said there's no reason this can't apply, this analysis can't apply to any Tabor case.
Tell me this, how do you adjust a mill levy for inflation and growth?
You take inflation and annual growth as percentages, you add them together, you multiply them times the 7.598 mill levy, and the next year in 1998 the mill levy can be increased by the board by that percentage, and you continue to do that every year. Trial court had difficulty with this, and there's a lot of discussion and closing argument about how you do this, but we presented a demonstrative exhibit that showed that this is not an unlimited increase, it's a capped formulaic increase that the board is allowed to take. And of course the option is if you think the board shouldn't be taking it, then you should get a new board.
Now, is the exhibit that the trial court used in its order at page 21, is that the result of the formula, of application of the formula?
I don't have the order with me.
Okay, there's a chart called maximum authorized mill levy by year using 1996 ballot formula adjusted for inflation and local growth. And it was the district's demonstrative exhibit one.
Yes, I think that's it. You're saying page 23 of the order?
21. So is that like a visual representation of?
That's a visual representation of a chart we used demonstratively that showed how this was calculated year by year. And this shows that the district stayed under the formula in each and every year.
Okay, so the top figure is the formula, application of the formula.
Correct.
Okay.
and the line is where the mill levy was set.
That, in your view, that demonstrates that there is a cap. For example, in 2010, they couldn't raise the mill levy to 20.
Correct. They could only raise it to 13.37.
And so from 97 to 98, we have this increase of, what, about 0.45?
Yes.
And that results from inflation plus growth.
Correct.
As a percentage over 4% or whatever.
Yes.
And you can increase your mill levy by 4%.
Correct.
And then there's an issue here, is there not, about whether you can go back and recapture?
No, because I think it was conceded that if the formula is valid and it's appropriate under Tabor and under the analysis specifically of the question, and if that question said you may do this, then I'm saying we have done this. That's what this chart shows, that we have actually stayed within the limits that we say govern our board.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we'll give you another 3.5 minutes, please. I think we asked questions at least that long. Maybe 3 minutes and 35 seconds. Yes, if you'd put that on the clock. Seem to be having difficulty with that, so I have a watch.
Okay, thank you.
Use my watch.
Mine's not very precise. Let me start out. Mr. Nathan is, as we discussed in both our opening brief and reply brief, incorrect when he says there are cases addressing formulas that are not bond cases. The reason the bond cases allow you to increase the mill levy using a formula is because bond obligations have a specific amount that has to be paid. So if for some reason your maximum mill levy that is in the ballot question for the bond issue, if that amount, when applied to your assessed value, is not enough to make that bond payment, then you can bump up your mill levy because you've got an obligation to the bondholders. Those are the only formula cases. No one has a formula for operations and maintenance. And in fact, I disagree strongly with Mr. Nathan's characterization of government. Tabor's whole intent is to limit growth of government. What they argue has resulted in an increase in the mill levy with no voter approval from a maximum not to exceed 7.598 to the current mill levy of 11.11. That is growth in government as that term is used in Tabor. That interpretation does not make sense. It's totally inconsistent with the whole concept of Tabor.
But you've conceded that it doesn't violate Tabor. I mean, my understanding is...
What doesn't?
As I understand it, and I admit that it's a bit confusing, but that at the trial level, it was conceded that if their interpretation is correct, their interpretation does not violate Tabor.
Let's put this in context. I think my words have been taken out of context. And if you look at the transcript, you'll see the context of the question and the answer. If the court decided that there was a formula for an operations and maintenance mill levy like this that was approved by the voters, our claim that they collected too much revenue, spent too much revenue, would be wrong. So that would not be a Tabor violation. And again, we're not trying to say the ballot question violates Tabor. We're saying this, the way it's applied and being interpreted is what's in violation of Tabor. So that's the context of it.
Are you also claiming that Tabor itself prohibits use of a formula? And if so, where within Tabor would we find that prohibition?
I don't think anybody's ever applied the formula approach, notwithstanding what Mr. Nathan said, and you can read the transcript for yourself, to an operations and maintenance mill levy. No one's ever tried it, because it applies, formulas do apply under Tabor, but only to bond situations, because under Tabor, there's an express exception for bonds to give them the opportunity to use a formulaic approach to increasing the mill levy. So formulas are allowed under Tabor, but they are expressly limited to bonds as I read Tabor. That's my feeling about this. Now, the court asked, and since I'm supposed to be here for rebuttal, would it change your opinion if there was a dollar amount? As I mentioned, the trial court in its judgment, ordering judgment, at 2031 in the record, said the parties agree that if the amount was in there, then the mill levy would be limited to not in excess of 7.598. That also is discussed at length in our opening brief on page 8. I think you'll find that it makes sense, and that's what we were referring to earlier. I think they would change their opinion, and in fact, getting back to the formula question that was just asked, as Mr. Nathan would like you to believe, that there is savings clause language when it talks about the extent permitted by the constitutional amendment in question. It is not savings clause language. In fact, it's what Mr. Kim mistakenly used in 1997, and you look at Exhibit 89, page 2. In that exhibit, Mr. Kim tries to use the collection and spending provisions of Tabor in Section 7 to increase the tax rate, which is a Section 4 area. And so, you know, he's referring to something he's grafting into the election question that's just not there. Plus, it's wrong. The last thing I would say as to this cap, there is a cap, if you want to call it annually, but there's no cap. It keeps going, and it keeps going and going and going. That's what the chart shows you. There's no cap. There's no maximum 7.598 mills. It just keeps going. You can increase it by inflation. You can increase it by growth. Then you apply that to the assessed value, which already has inflation and growth in it. There is no limit.
Let me ask this, because I was focusing initially on this phrasing, to the extent permitted by Article 10. And Mr. Nathan said that, well, the next two sections address that such voter-approved revenue change to be an exception to the limits which would otherwise apply. And as I understand, what he's saying is that expresses an exception to the Tabor revenue limit. And then the third paragraph, or the third section, expresses a debrucing of the spending limit.
Actually, I think you said both sections,
yeah.
2 and 3, debrucing sections, and
right.
He's right. They have nothing to do with the tax rate. They're now trying to take that second section and make it part of the first phrase, which is just not correct.
So you accept that that this initiative totally debruces the revenue and spending limits that Tabor would otherwise apply?
I believe that's what the second and third phrases were intended to do. As Mr. Grayer pointed out in the letter that's in the record, there's some question about whether they were successful in doing it, but the intent was, with those second and third phrases, to debruce so that they could collect the money raised by this tax rate increase in phrase one and spend it. And I truly think that's what they were trying to do with that, because that's the way you usually do it, is you get the rate raised, and then you say, and by the way, we can collect it and spend it, because those are the three prongs of Tabor.
But you would, I guess the question I have is this, is that, does this say for all time, Section 7 and 8 of Tabor don't apply hereafter ever to anything? In other words, let's say that the mill levy stays the same,
yeah,
and yet the revenues increase. Can they keep those revenues and can they spend them?
Today the answer is yes. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, the answer would have been maybe it's limited to 4 years. The modern philosophy in the case law makes it clear, once you debruce on the collection and spending, you're good to go forever on that. But you still have to do new ballot issues if you want to increase your mill levy rate, which is what everybody does. You want to bump it above 7.598, you go out with a new ballot question, and it doesn't have to have that debruising language because the old one's still good for that.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That was very helpful. This case now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.